Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs radio program produced by campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. The show is podcast at globalresearch.ca and airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. This week, as part of our 2017 summer series, we air audio from a conference in Winnipeg centered around the dangers of NATO in a post-Cold War era. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was officially founded on April 4, 1949 in Washington, D.C. Headquartered in Brussels, Belgium, NATO is comprised of 29 member states, including Canada, the United States, and 27 European countries. Added to the list since the fall of the Berlin Wall, which marked the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union, 13 new states have been added to the list of member states, 10 of which were former Warsaw Pact countries. In the popular imagination, NATO was conceived as a vanguard against aggression from the Soviet Union, so one might reasonably conclude that the time has come for NATO to disband. Clearly, NATO in the current era has either found a new role for itself or is continuing a role it had clandestinely served since its creation. The Winnipeg Conference, which took place roughly on the 68th anniversary of NATO's founding, made an effort to probe that agenda and put it in the context of larger economic and geopolitical currents. The morning lectures took place at the University of Manitoba. The special guest presenters at this conference were Mahdi Darius Nazimroya, Paul Kellogg, and Roger Annis. The event was sponsored by the University of Manitoba's Geopolitical Economy Research Group in association with Peace Alliance Winnipeg, the Manitoba Chair for Global Governance Studies, the University of Manitoba Institute for the Humanities, the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba, and the Department of Political Science at the University of Winnipeg. Radhika Desai, professor at the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group, functioned as lead, organizer, and convener. She opened with a few remarks.
Since the end of the Cold War, NATO deployments have proliferated. How can we make sense of this if we consider the fact that NATO was supposed to be the West's weapon, the West's chief response to the rise of communism? Communism does not exist, but NATO is more active than ever before. A second consideration I'd like to lay before you is that at the end of the Cold War, everybody thought we were the bipolar world had been transformed into a unipolar world. This too has come a cropper. Just like the expectation of the peace dividend, the expectation that we would live in a unipolar world no longer seems to obtain. On the contrary, what has happened is that since that time, as the West has continued to stagnate, experiencing low growth rates, which actually date back before the 2008 recession, on the other hand, various other countries have, particularly led by China, of course, China being far in the front of all the emerging economies, have continued to post relatively high growth rates, which means that they have begun to shift the center of gravity of the world economy away from the West for the first time since the beginnings of capitalism. This is very important also for one other reason. It represents a time when, for the first time in the history of capitalism, new countries emerging and spreading productive power worldwide is not something new. It has happened before many times. In my own writing, I have named 1870, when three powers, Germany, United States, and Japan, rose to challenge British supremacy as the world's first multipolar moment, which was then added to by the Soviet Revolution and so on and so forth. I don't want to go through all that epic tale at this point, but that in itself is not new. But what will be new if this trend continues, and there are a lot of reasons to believe it will continue, is that for the first time, colonized or semi-colonized countries of the world will be emerging as major centers of world production. I think this represents an important development. And so the post-Cold War period has not been, or the post-Cold War, new Cold War, whatever you want to call it, period, has not been one of unipolarity, but rather of a accelerating transition towards multipolarity as the West declines and other countries emerge. Finally, today's lectures should also be put in one other important context. As you know, even in the Obama years, but certainly since the end of the Obama administration and the inauguration of the Trump administration, it has been increasingly difficult to try and understand what is happening with, you know, Obama was supposed to pull back troops, and he has become a sort of a new president of American aggression, the drone president, etc., etc. So, and of course, with the Trump administration, we are seeing all sorts of extremely contradictory messages emanating from the White House. NATO is useless. On the other hand, allies have to spend more on NATO. We are going to, you know, that there was some indication during the campaign that the American administration was going to draw in its claws, but in fact, President Trump has increased the military budget very massively, as you know, in a historically significant fashion. So all these things also form the questions to which I think the three lectures that are being given today will give us some really interesting and useful answers.
Mahdi Nazemroya is a sociologist and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization, currently working out of the University of the Philippines. He is the author of The Globalization of NATO, a contributor at the Strategic Culture Foundation, Moscow, and a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica in Italy. The focus of his talk was NATO, from the Atlantic to the Indian and Pacific Oceans.
For years after the disbanding of the Soviet dominated Warsaw Pact and the collapse of the USSR, NATO was viewed as a relic of the Cold War. With the threat of a Soviet invasion from Eastern Europe against Western Europe, with that threat gone, NATO had lost its raison d'etre. This is the Soviet threat, the Red Menace, the Communists, whatever you'd like to, however way you want to talk about them. In 1991, something happens. An latent act happens, an unseen, an unknowable, in terms of people didn't realize what happened. NATO had been silently involved in major military operations in the Gulf War. The first NATO war is the Gulf War. How it happened was, informally, all NATO allies were involved and all NATO plans for war were utilized in Iraq. They used the Gulf War as a testing ground for NATO strategies against the Soviet Union Warsaw Pact. In fact, it would not have been possible without the structure of NATO being present, the interoperability. It would have never been. They used, for example, the Germans, all the tanks they got from East Germany after unification were used. They used the NATO strategies for fighting the Soviet tanks against Iraq. All of this, the entire resources of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was used, and on informal in planning circles, they said, wow, we can do much more with this alliance. So NATO had silently been involved in major military operations in the Gulf War. This brightened the eyes of the Pentagon, and they considered the future possibilities. What are the future possibilities? Yugoslavia, the Federal Socialist Republic of Yugoslavia. Disintegration and devolving Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia saw NATO conduct several military campaigns in the Eastern European region of the Balkans. This was the first time that it was formal, and they used humanitarian grounds. And this was offensive. It's not defensive. The mandate has changed. If you attack us, we all will react collectively, but the mandate now changed. We get involved for humanitarian context. It intervened militarily in Bosnia in 1995. Next, it waged an aerial war over the fate of the predominantly Albanian-inhabited Serbian province of Kosovo against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which is a smaller Yugoslavia. It's Serbia and Montenegro. Later, it changes its name to that. In 2001, NATO boots were deployed on the soil of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which NATO's Kosovo Liberation Army allies had been destabilizing. The events in the Balkans during the 1990s would be followed by the US-led invasion of Taliban-controlled Afghanistan in the same year as the NATO deployment into Macedonia. NATO agreed to support the US in the global war on terror under Article 5. The collective defense article of the treaty was invoked in 2001. So terrorism now comes into the fold. Then anti-piracy operations, maritime security comes into the fold. The mandate of this treaty, of this organization, is outside of the treaty, the legal parameters of the treaty. So NATO launched a policing mission to control the Mediterranean Sea called Operation Active Endeavor. And this is the first time that NATO's zone of operations expands officially the entire Mediterranean. The Eastern Mediterranean is now included. It goes on. The International Security Assistance Force goes 2003 into Afghanistan. This allows British and American troops to go to Iraq. What happens is your allies come in, take your place under whatever auspices you want to say, peacekeeping or as belligerents. They're both belligerents, if you ask me, in Afghanistan. And what happens is you're free to go attack Iraq. That's what Canada, by the way, did. I know from the former government under John Chrétien, members of that government, the debate within that was for this. They could, the public would not agree to, they believed that the public would not be happy if Canada went to Iraq. So what they did is they agreed with the Americans, we'll send troops to Afghanistan, you can send troops to Iraq. So that's how Canada is involved in these wars. In the 1990s, there was a continuous reference by U.S. policymakers and Pentagon officials to Islam and a coming conflict in the Islamic world. Secretary General at the time would actually go so far as to say that Islam had become NATO's newest concern or threat. The military planners of the Pentagon and NATO also began contemplating in the 1990s, after the Cold War, missions to places in Africa like Somalia, Rwanda, and Congo. And in fact, they do go to Somalia. There's a NATO mission in Somalia. There's a NATO mission in Sudan, which you might not be aware about. It's NATO that directs and orders the African Union troops in both these countries. By 2001 onward, if it had not been already apparent in the late 1990s, it was clear that NATO was no longer just a defensive pact intended for mutual defense. It was operating in more than five different regions of the world, from the valleys of Afghanistan to the skies of East Africa and the waters of the coasts of Cuba and Greenland. The post-Cold War NATO is actively pursuing combat missions and international policing duties of airspace and international waters. NATO is publicly taking on itself to impose what its political leaders have claimed to be the maintenance of international law and stability, and a new mandate also for energy security. In 2006-2007, in the Baltic states, there was a big conference, and energy security was discussed. And in fact, what was said there is if a country does not provide energy, it threatens our energy security. A country is being designated as a military threat for not giving its resources. That's the new, that is the new norm that was starting to be established or legitimized. I should say during the Cold War, the U.S. had a network of Cold War alliances. NATO is the one I'm talking about, but there's also CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, MITO, the Middle East Treaty Organization, CENTO, it later evolves into the Central Treaty Organization, and then there was the Australia-New Zealand-United States Security Treaty, which broke up into two bilateral treaties because of New Zealand's refusal to allow nuclear weapons on its territory, which was, I mean, a very good thing on the part of the government in New Zealand. What this did is, and I will touch on it later, is it creates a chain of alliances around Russia, the Soviet Union, and China. There is a chain of alliances encircling them. NATO is on the far west of the Eurasian landmass. CENTO was in the center, and in the east was the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, CETO. Britain is a member of all three of these military alliances. France is a member of two. Turkey, Pakistan is part of CETO and the Middle East Treaty Organization. Turkey's part of NATO and CENTO. So you can see that this belt is created. You go to war with one of these countries, it ignites a response from the other alliances. So the United States and these organizations, whether it's by design or not, what it essentially does is it creates three military fronts that would light up at the same time because of joint memberships. I'm talking about NATO in terms of its world presence. So the term globalization, this mystified or changing term, as Radhika put it the other night, the goalposts change, which is absolutely correct. I think we have to take a look at it because it's part of the picture. The term comes first into use in 1944, but why I want to look at the term is it's tied to U.S. foreign policy and the idea of a borderless world as agreed upon in the Atlantic Charter in 1941. That's why I'm using that term. The United States and Britain off the coast of Newfoundland had a meeting. The Atlantic Charter was created. It talks about a borderless world. What essentially that means is U.S. corporations can go anywhere they want in the world. That was more or less the agreement. The borderless world meant that European empires, Western European empires to be precise, had to dismantle their empires. Why? Well, an empire, first of all, is a state of some sort, and there's preferential trade agreements. I mean, Britain and its colonies, it's internal, the trade, more or less, or France and its colonies. Once you dismember this empire, then there can never be between this core, this mother country, whatever you'd however way you want to describe it, there can't be that type of preferential trade. So it allows American corporations to move in. These were the agreements, basically Britain. It's a concession on the part of Britain, but it's also talking about a redesigned world. When a country becomes a NATO member, it has to, first of all, be joined something that's called, it has to become a partner first. It doesn't get full entry. It needs to, it is put on it has to prove that it's ready to join. Under those conditions, there has to be economic reforms. There has to be the military budget has to be transparent. They want to know what the military budget is. If you want to work with NATO, you have to have a transparent military budget. There's a reason for that. They want to see how you spend your expenditures, where it's going to. There's a business aspect. There's a security aspect to that. So these things come into play. I'll skip that. This organization, Association of Southeastern Asian Nations, was promoted by the United States, just like the European Union was also promoted. The U.S. position is that the European Union expands the influence of the United States. It expands the Euro-Atlantic zone. The American, Washington's position is also that ASEAN can expand U.S. influence in Southeastern Asia. And if you look at what U.S. policy planners, strategic planners talk about, is they talk about we need bases, footholds in Asia and Europe. This is one of their footholds, an important entry point for encirclement. This is why ASEAN and CETO more or less come about at the same time. This started off as a community like the European Union, but there is a linkage between the expansion of the European Union and NATO. If you look, actually, NATO expansion comes always first, then European Union. It's the same here. What role do Sino-U.S. relations play in defining the Asia-Pacific regions? What role do they play in ASEAN? What about the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Let me say, the head of China asserted in 1991 that a new Cold War, the word war is there twice, had begun between the United States and China. He said the Cold War between Moscow and Washington's over. The Cold War is now a new phase. It's between us and the United States. For the U.S., in the words of Brzezinski, China is unfinished business. So the Chinese, what's happening in the Asia-Pacific, and it includes NATO, is they are trying to cordon off and encircle China. They're continuing the policy from the Cold War. It's in a new phase. It's being reorganized, re-merchandised, if you will, represented. It's a new face to what's happening. And this is part of the, Brazil maybe is now no longer there, but it's part of this push against these BRICS countries that are now becoming centers in their own right. It's against concepts like a Eurasian Economic Union. Or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the new Silk Road, or Silk Roads. And NATO is playing a role in de-dollarization. These countries that are outside of the orbit of the United States have agreements with each other to make Iran and Russia, China and Russia. They use each other's currencies. That includes the ALBA countries. So So the Asia Pacific is being remilitarized. Japan no longer follows it. It's in blatant breach of its constitution. It's also even talking about nuclear weapons. Australia and New Zealand are back with the United States. New Zealand now will allow U.S. nuclear weapons on its soil. And more or less, NATO is being helped, is helping create a de facto CETO. What happened is, when there was a Sino-Soviet split, when Beijing and Moscow had problems, Beijing and the United States, to different degrees, worked together. And this, the United States no longer prioritized CETO, and it became defunct. Now it can't rebuild CETO. It wants to rebuild this military grouping, but it's tying it into NATO. So the pivot to the Asia-Pacific, as Hillary Clinton announced in foreign policy, it's not new. It's very old. It starts with the United States makes an agreement with Japan. You take Korea, we'll take the Philippines. This is an agreement between the State Department and Japan. You recognize us in the Philippines, we recognize you in Korea. They've been pivoting there since decades. It's not new at all. South China Sea, let's focus on it, and the East China Sea. The Chinese, to justify what's happening, the Chinese are being portrayed as antagonists, violators, aggressive. It's not true. If you look at China after the Cold War, it's the country that's actually given up the most territory. It's given up territory to Vietnam, even though there's a dispute between the two. It's actually been very calm and relaxed on a lot of issues. I'm not here to say any China's a bed of roses, but in reality, what's happening is China is being demonized to justify U.S. military position there and the encirclement of the People's Republic of China. The geopolitical strategy of the U.S. is it's a classical sea power versus land power. It includes incorporation, it includes restructuring regions and people. It comes from the ideas of Mackinder. So Mackinder talks about the heartland. It's about controlling the heartland, and if you control the heartland, you control the world island. The world island is Eurasia, Europe, Asia, and Africa. And he says if you control it, U.S. strategists don't subscribe to this. They believe in more the rimland is the way to control the heartland. And they see Eastern Europe is falling in, Western Europe is falling into the rimland. And that's the strategy that comes about through Nicholas Spikeman. You can see the rimland there, and that's where most American bases are located. It's in that area. Those three military alliances are there. China and Russia, well, China's in the rimland as well, but that heartland is where Russia and China are. I just want to quote Spikeman. Any proposal for the unification of Europe would tend to put Europe in a subordinate position to Germany, regardless of the legal provisions of the agreement, since Germany, unless broken up into fragments, will still be the biggest nation of the continent. This is another quote. The most important single fact in the American security situation is the question of who controls the rimlands of Europe and Asia. Should these get into the hands of a single power or combination of powers hostile to the United States, the resulting encirclement would put us in a position of grave peril, regardless of the size of our army and navy. The reality of this threat has been dimly realized in the past. On the two recent occasions when a single power threatened to gain control of the European mainland, we have become involved in a war to stop it. But our efforts have been belated and have been carried out at huge cost to ourselves. Had we been fully conscious of the implications of our geographical location in the world, we might have adopted a foreign policy which would have helped to prevent the threat from arising in the first place. This is after the Cold War. After World War II. These statements are towards the end and after World War II. What this is saying is we cannot provide any dominant power. And our policy has to openly try to keep everybody weak. It's an adoption of British policy in Europe. The British policy is keep the Continentals weak. That was it, and the Americans inherit this. I also want to prove a point. The word CENTO means Central Treaty Organization. It's been established. I think that should be clear. Guess what? The United States has a military command, geographic command, which it also calls United States Central Command. Why does it call it United States Central Command? This shows that, this proves that even CENTO, the naming, the organizing of it, it's from the Washington Beltway. It's from an American perspective. Because that is the central front for the United States in the encirclement of Eurasia. NATO is the Western front, and Sito was in the Eastern Front. And for them, that's the Central Front. We should not forget that global events, they're tied to one another. For example, the coup in Caracas in Venezuela in 2002, one of the main purposes was they wanted cheap Venezuelan oil ready when Iraqi output was out. That's the official position of the Venezuelan government based on U.S. documents. Hugo Chavez himself readily says this. They wanted to take our country in 2002 because they were ready to attack Iraq and they wanted our oil, cheap oil. The price of oil would have risen and they also needed, they wanted to use our oil for the war. So you might look at places like Ukraine, you might look at places like Syria. Do not think that these are all separate. There is a linkage. In fact, in Ukraine, people that are tied to Chechen separatists who used to fight the Russians in the 1990s, who are now fighting in Iraq and Syria under the banners of ISIL, they're also fighting in Ukraine on the side of the Ukrainian National Guard. So these people who are supposedly jihadists, who want to kill Christians and Jews and Shiite Muslims, it's very odd that they're bedfellows. It's not impossible, but they're bedfellows with the National Guard in Ukraine. So the discourse, there's a discourse that's communicating a wrong message, and that's why we're talking more about fake news nowadays. The discourse is there to justify policies of demonization and otherization, and a clash of civilizations is also part of this discourse, I think. It's trying to say, for example, Samuel Huntington's political project says that the Cold War was a civil war in the West. That's how he says it in his book. The Cold War is a civil war in Western civilization. Yet, a few pages down, he says Russia is not part of Western civilization. How can it be a civil war in the West, and yet Russia is not a part of Western civilization? Russia, whenever Russia is targeted, it's presented as this Asiatic country, non-European country. And this is part of the process, to say it's part of this Orthodox civilization. To say that there's a cynic, I mean, there are differences, but I think that from my personal standpoint, whether you agree or not, there's a human civilization. I don't adhere to this model which just puts Latin America arbitrarily there for outside of West or Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, without even knowing the diversities. But these type of models are being presented, cultural models, saying, for example, trying to put Ukraine and Russia on different cultural boundaries. I think more or less economic dimensions, we can't ignore the economic dimensions which the previous speaker brought about, but we also rivalries, the military dimensions, and we can't ignore the discourse of justification for free markets. I mean, it's putting the world on the brink of what could potentially be very dangerous. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in the last few years has given the highest, they say it's closer to midnight than most the Cold War. And we're not aware of these things. We should be aware of these things. What's happening in the demonization of the Chinese and Russians, as well as others, including Venezuela, you have to understand the processes behind this. You have to reflect on them. Nobody's saying that there's any, it's black and white, but you do need to reflect on these issues, and you need to ask yourself, why is Canada in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which has a defensive mandate, when they're no longer, is a threat, even the documents of the NATO's stop using the word threat after or danger after the Cold War. What this is something as Canadians we need to ask ourselves. We need to. It's something people of respectable conscience need to ask themselves also. So, without any more ado, thank you.
That was Mahdi Nazemroya speaking at last April's Winnipeg conference on the dangers of NATO in the post-Cold War era. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour 2017 summer series airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is also podcast and available for download on the website globalresearch.ca. My name is Michael Welch. On this week's program, we are airing audio from a conference on the dangers of NATO in a post-Cold War era, held on April 3, 2017, in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Paul Kellogg is an associate professor in the Center for Interdisciplinary Studies at Athabasca University and writes extensively about Canada and international political economy, Marxist theory, and social movements. His most recent book is entitled Escape from the Staple Trap, Canadian Political Economy After Left Nationalism, published by University of Toronto Press. His talk was focused on the political economy of the current period of militarism and was entitled Addicted to War, the Corporate Foundation of U.S. Militarism.
The difference between what the U.S. government spends on arms and every other state in the world is incredible. That's the first point that I want to make. Why do I say this is abnormal? Because while the U.S. has just 5% of the world's population, the arms spending that I've documented here represents almost half of the world's totals. Other states don't do this on this scale. It's interesting to me that in the 1990s, when defense spending was lower, this is a chart of battle-related deaths going back to 1989 to 2010, the 1990s were a worse decade for battle-related deaths than the first decade of the 21st century. It's not driven by a massive you don't have a massive upward spike in battlefield deaths and therefore a massive upward spike in military spending. It's happening for other reasons. We have to turn to arms spending as economics. I do not believe that arms spending is primarily driven by military policy. I believe it's primarily driven by as economics. There's a long story here. That's extremely interesting. The first couple of years after World War II were economically very difficult, as millions and tens of millions of soldiers were demobilized, as arms spending was ratcheted down. There was recessions and problems in many, many countries around the world, including the United States, including Canada. 46 to 47 were very, very difficult years. They stumbled into a solution. The Korean, what is called, euphemistically called the Korean War, which really should be called the war of U.S. against China, because the principal fight was between the United States and China, led to a stop to the whole demilitarization of the United States, a remilitarization, a return to arms spending, and the economy stabilized. And there was a very interesting, this correlation was noticed by a whole lot of people, that if we can be the world's big military power, We can have, there's lots of benefits that go with that. We're able to intervene into Latin America, able to keep the world safe for capitalism, and it also stabilizes the economy. John Maynard Keynes was one of the great economists of the 20th century, and he knew that capitalism by itself could not sustain, was crisis prone. Capitalism left, the market left to itself keeps getting you into crisis over and over and over again. He knew that states had to intervene into the economy in order to smooth out the ups and downs of the market cycle. And he was in despair towards the end of his life because he'd come to the conclusion that the ideologically driven people who were running the system in the capitalist states were ideologically completely opposed to state intervention, except when it came for warfare. And he, looking ahead, said, I am worried that we're going to get state intervention, but the only state intervention that's going to be allowed ideologically is military state intervention. In the case of the United States, he was completely right. Military Keynesianism was the result, priming the economy with arms spending, something feared by Keynes before his death. Problem. Military Keynesianism, while it does lead to economic growth, it leads to distorted economic growth. That's the next point I want to make. Remember the F-35. People know about this thing? This is the big jet that we're all supposed to buy. And it's going to... Who's Canada going to be fighting? I can't remember. It doesn't matter. It's like, that's the big jet that is being promoted as the next billion-dollar toy for the military-industrial complex. This is a map. The areas in green are areas of production and training for the F-35. Look at where they're situated. They're situated in the south and the west of the United States. Paul Koistinen, who's the author of a book called, a series of volumes called The Political Economy of American Warfare, calls this the Gun Belt. And he's saying, now we know of this as the Gun Belt for other reasons. We know of this as the Gun Belt because this is the place which deifies the right to carry arms and the Second Amendment and all that type of thing. The point he's making, it's a gun belt for other reasons, because there has been massive industrial development in the southwest of the United States, and it is driven by the Pentagon. It's driven by military production, and it doesn't come without a cost. Then, another little footnote. It's kind of strange what I'm talking about, because the United States, as a state, has a reputation as a polity that does not believe in industrial policy. The Europeans, they do industrial policy. They give subsidies to industry. America, we're the free market. You know, we let the free market rule. In fact, what Paul Coynston and others say is that the Pentagon directing billions of dollars of spending towards industry is actually a massive industrial policy. There is an industrial policy in the United States. There is a state intervention into the economy to stimulate industry. The chosen industry to stimulate is the building of nuclear submarines, nuclear jet planes, and all the rest of it. The creation of that gun belt, Paul Coynston makes the case, he says, goes in parallel to the creation of the Rust Belt, which we're more familiar with in the northeast of the United States. Cleveland and Buffalo, Detroit, Chicago, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, that area which was the core of the old civilian industries, the old civilian manufacturing base, which has gone into a long decline over many years. One last point. This is corporately driven. This is driven not by, not solely by state policy, although there's a lot of state policy involved. There's deeply embedded corporate interests at the heart of this. The SIPRI database keeps a list of the top 100 arms corporations in terms of annual arms sales. This is all adjusted for inflation in the world, excluding China. If you go back to 2002, that amounted to $290 billion of sales a year. It's gone up to $396 billion by 2015. The share of the United States of that was 61% in 88, 63.9% in 2002, 60% of sales from the top 100 corporations are based in the United States. I put Europe down there as a comparator just to take a look at it. It's about half the rate of the United States. But in terms of profits, the profit share that goes to the top 100 U.S. corporations is enormous. It's higher than the share of, in other words, these are extremely profitable corporations, extremely profitable activities for these top 100 corporations to engage in. In 2002, the year after the beginning of the war on, or what's called the war on terror, the war on Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, you can see the frenzy of spending that happens that leads to massive profits. 97.4% of the profits that year go to those top 100 U.S. corporations. It's a hugely profitable industry to get into. There's one last way of looking at this. These top 100 corporations are not simply involved in the production of arms, they're increasingly dependent upon them. Three clusters of years, 1988 on the left, 2002 in the middle, 2015. This is looking at the extent to which the corporations in the world as a whole, in the United States and Europe, are dependent on arms sales for their sales. You go back a generation to 1988, it's about 15-16%. You go to 2002, it's up to 20%. In our area, it's skyrocketed to more than a third. Increasingly, these corporations are dependent upon arms sales. They're embedded, it's like a drug addict who needs a bigger and bigger hit to get the same high, if you want to think of it that way. So that's the drug addict. You go back here, that's the effect. The effect of it is to hollow out whole areas of the country to make the country sick. I'm going to pull it to a close. I've got lots of other ways of looking at it. If you want a list of all the corporations in the U.S. that are involved in this, the big one is Lockheed Martin, there's Raytheon, Northrop Grumman. You can ask me about them in discussion. If you want to take a look at specifics, Lockheed Martin is the one that was made famous by Michael Moore in Bowling for Columbine. Everything he said about it is true. It's by 2011, only 1% of its production was for civilian uses. Everything else goes to the military. Think of Boeing Corporation. We love Boeing. Don't we love Boeing? It's the Dreamliner. The Dreamliner that's going to take us places. And the Boeing 747, that big jumbo jet, it's a wonderful corporation. Half of Boeing Corporation's sales are embedded in the military. It used to be about 20%, it's now half. It is a military corporation, it is dependent on the military. How do we conclude this? Because I should bring it to a close. This is the tip of the iceberg. The most important industry in the world is the oil industry. I haven't even factored this into the whole thing. The biggest consumer of oil in the world is the US military. That has to be thought of as an embedded part of the corporate militarism that I'm talking about. How one would do that would be a research project that would be complicated, but it could be done. The form of an organization like NATO is as a military alliance. NATO presents itself as a military alliance, which it is, but it is more than that. It is also the legitimate face of corporate state militarism. It legitimizes the processes behind here, which are not really driven by the security needs of states, but are driven by the corporate needs of corporate capitalism. Corporate state militarism is inherently unstable. While it benefits U.S. corporations in the short term, in the long term it undermines the political and economic environment in which they operate. I've talked about the distortion of public finances. I've talked about the skewing of industrial policy away from civilian production towards arms production. There are other bigger problems, which I'm going to look at in the presentation in the evening. Corporate state militarism is dangerous. The economic logic of the warfare states puts us constantly at risk of the guns being actually used. And we all know that. That's one I don't need to embellish very much. Corporate state militarism cannot be challenged piecemeal. Our new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, presents himself as a 21st century kind of guy. You know, he's in sync with all of the modern, progressive, hip things that go on. And he sanctioned the $15 billion sale of military equipment to Saudi Arabia. That puts him in bed with the entire logic of corporate militarism, corporate state militarism that I've talked about here. He's a hip guy, you know? Because it's 2015 was his answer to why he was doing things and it was a 50, you know, because it's 2015. Well, because it was 2015, is that why he is so for the Keystone XL pipeline? And what will the Keystone XL pipeline do? It embeds the Canadian oil industry in the logic of corporate state militarism for the reason that I've talked about, I referred to, biggest user of oil in the world, biggest single user is the American military machine. Trudeau is feeding this with his... You can't have it both ways. You can't both be a progressive person in words and a reactionary in your actions. And these two actions, the arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the agreement to the Keystone XL, are reactionary in themselves and interestingly in sync with the corporate logic of militarism that I have outlined earlier. So, the conclusion, once again, is quite simple. We have to oppose this corporate state militarism, which is at the center of world capitalism, and to oppose it, you have to also combat the capitalism itself. You can't choose to just do one without the other. The two logics are completely in sync like this. It's daunting, but it's the only conclusion that I can come to from looking at this research. And that's it.
No stranger to regular Global Research NewsHour listeners, Roger Annis is a longtime socialist and retired aerospace worker based in Vancouver. He writes regularly on topics related to peace and social justice, and in particular, he has written extensively on Canada's involvement in Haiti and more recently in Ukraine. He's the founding editor of the newcoldwar.org website. The focus of his talk was Post-Cold War NATO, Why Conflict Continues and the Prospects for Peace.
Now, I don't have to tell you that we live in a dangerous world. It's a world of deepening war and militarism, and my two previous colleagues have given you quite a view of that, and just how deep and fundamental a problem that is to the world system that we have. We live in a world of permanent war, and if we don't take steps to end this world of permanent war, it's going to get a lot worse. Certainly what's at stake in the NATO conflict against Russia sparked by events in Ukraine, and that's how I describe what's gone on in the past 3 years. What's at stake there is nothing less than the danger of nuclear war. But there's two other major dangers that we face in the world that we have to take into account when we look at NATO in particular and the whole world, as I think Marty has shown as well. When we talk of NATO, we're not simply talking about Europe. One are the growing social and economic inequalities in the world, which are worsening. Doesn't mean everybody's getting poorer, but on a relative scale, the majority of the world is getting worse off, not better. And then the third grave danger we face is, of course, an out-of-control global warming emergency. And we really need to have the three of these put together in a common view of the world in order to understand where we're going and what needs to be done to reverse course and put us on the path towards a world of social equality, but also a world in which we care for the environment and we care for the ecology. We don't regard the environment as some endless storehouse that we can simply go in and steal from and wreck and destroy and not consider what that means for future generations. Why are we facing these incessant wars that are only deepening? Well, it has to do with the economic imperatives of the major imperialist countries that control the world, and which are each one of them led by their own wealthy class of capitalists who own the banks and the industrial corporations and all the rest. And Canada is a member of NATO, a fully fledged member of NATO, and one of the top economic powers of the world, is very much part of this. It's NATO's and all of these imperialist countries' relentless drive to grab as much as they can of the wealth that is generated by the labor of ordinary human beings and the natural resources that lay there in the ground, in the water, and in the earth. But they run into a problem in this, which is the resistance of ordinary people to all of this exploitation and despoliation. It's called, Marxists call it the class struggle. And that's, you know, a term to use simply, or a term to describe the natural inclination of human beings to come together and take care of one another. And so when we work for a company that wants to pay us pitiful wages, or if we're in the third world, we're not even getting paid enough to put food on our table, well, of course, there's a natural inclination for us to come together as human beings, form trade unions, form student associations, form farmers' organizations, to strengthen our First Nations governing institutions and organizations to fight against them. And this is the driving force of history. This is what Karl Marx wrote in, and Frederick Engels wrote in their path-breaking works. A class struggle is the driving force of history. And what they mean by that simply is human beings want to live in a fair and just world, and we will come together and fight to achieve that. And that's a great thing, because without it, we'd be slaves still. We'd be serfs still. We've advanced, but we haven't advanced all the way that we need to. So NATO symbolizes all of these ills because it's the mechanism, it's the military mechanism by which they enforce their rule. That's what armies do, and that's what police forces do. They enforce the inequalities of society. So worse than blocking progress, NATO is worsening the situation in the world. And I don't need to remind you of the destruction of Libya, literally the destruction of a country. Yemen, the near destruction of Syria, though I believe the Syrian people have turned a corner on that. Afghanistan, again, we're talking destructions of entire societies and countries, not wars that have killed some people. All of these terribly destructive wars. Well, I mean, to understand this, we really have to go back to the wreckage of 1945. 1945 was a world of complete destruction. And the capitalists couldn't go on ruling the world like this anymore. They nearly lost the world. They lost a third of the world. There was a revolution in 1917 in Russia that opened what is still, we live in the era of socialist revolution, where that possibility of making a societal leap towards a society of equality and justice exists. And the Russian Revolution, and most certainly in its earliest years, but even in its later years, set a model. And then there was the incredible revolution in China, which succeeded in 1949, which opened the door to the decolonization of the entire world. But this is the most important thing. Well, apart from the social development of China itself, the Chinese Revolution opened the door to the decolonization of the entire world. You had anti-capitalist revolutions in Eastern Europe, And then not so much later after World War II in Korea, in Vietnam, in 1959 in Cuba, and many, many other countries of the world that attempted to get this capitalist system off their backs. And because of these revolutions in the that were all in the third world countries, the capitalists had to make significant concessions to workers and to young people and to not so much the First Nations people, that came later through struggle, but the welfare state was born as a way of buying off social revolution, because if the capitalists didn't concede the welfare state, then they were going to have revolutions like Russia's and like China's, and they knew that, so they had to do it. So what the capitalists, the only thing they could do in 1945 was to begin to assemble the apparatus to contain this, contain their losses, prevent the further social revolutions from taking place. And they did so with force and violence. Even in the developed capitalist countries in Western Europe, where countries like Italy and France were kind of on the edge of carrying through a social revolution that would kind of resemble what they saw happening in Eastern Europe. But certainly in the Third World, where they faced challenges all over the Third World, and they lost many of those challenges after World War II. But that was their goal, was containment. And that was what NATO was about, was containing the example and the achievement that had been won by the Soviet people. And when I say the Soviet people, I don't mean just the Russian people. I mean the Ukrainian people, the Georgian people, this multinational entity that became the Soviet Union and that accomplished great things socially and economically even before World War II, but certainly following it. And so it was a strategy of containment, biding time, and essentially trying to starve into submission these countries. That's what the Cold War was about. I mean, they literally embargoed the Soviet Union, but they also tried to cripple it with the arms race and with all of the other forms of economic competition that the Soviet Union was obliged to respond to. The Soviet Union didn't go out and try and equal the United States in armaments because, you know, it had some inherent interest in an arms industry the way that Paul has described the United States. That, no, it was simple self-defense. If they didn't do it, they'd be destroyed. I think there's a lot of, in my view, the events in Ukraine in particular spark a need, an understanding of the need for much deeper analysis of what's gone on in the world. Why did the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China not continue? What did Russia, the new Russia and the new China, what did they become? Even though they're capitalist countries, you know, a recent study said Russia is one of the most unequal countries in the world. That is the gap between rich and poor. Proportionally, we're not talking about money. I mean, by far the most unequal country of the border is just south, in the world, it's just south of the border. But it's a capitalist country. Russia has a lot of responsibility for the global warming emergency because it's the biggest combined oil and gas producer in the world. But nonetheless, here are capitalist countries because they don't have the same imperialist dynamic towards expansion. Endless expansion. Russia would be quite happy just to be left on its own. It's got more than enough problems in its national space and in its periphery to solve. It doesn't need the oil of Syria. It doesn't need the plantations of Africa and so on. Does that mean that Russia is like a new socialist country or something? Or that the people of Russia can just kind of go to bed and not worry about all the poverty that's there? And so, no, but it's become a different world in the past 25 years, and we have capitalist countries that are emerging that have the capacity to stand up to the United States. And when they do that, they create space for people like you and I to survive. Look at what happened in Crimea. Barely a loss of life that Crimea was able to get out of this threatened right-wing government by Kiev. By contrast, in the Donbass area of eastern Ukraine alone, the war in the last 3 years, the civil war in the last 3 years, has caused more than 10,000 deaths. And we have the most recent figures from a study in Germany. 3 million people displaced from the regions of Donetsk and Lugansk in eastern Ukraine. It's called Donbass. It's a historic area that's largely Russian-speaking. Contrast the two. Crimea has incredible economic prospects ahead of it. They're building a bridge across the Kerch Strait. And on. I mean, compared to the stagnation that it lived. So that's just one example. My thoughts on what we need to do in this country to be building a new anti-war movement, or a renewal of an anti-war movement, which, by the way, has accomplished a great deal. When you see the Canadian government going around today, not able, for example, to fulfill its commitment to intervene militarily in Africa with a 600-member force that it wants to intervene. It said so. The Trudeau government has said so since last year. What's the problem? Well, because we have a lot of things that have been achieved over the last 15 years, and particularly through the anti-war movement, the movement against the war in Iraq in 2003. So we're building upon what we've already accomplished. But, you know, we need to be back in the streets in our hundreds and thousands to really affect the course of events. Now, it doesn't mean we're all going to, you know, we're going to go out and form, you know, anti-war groups tomorrow that it would have, you know, a platform like that. These are, you know, these are complicated issues, and they've been divisive because we haven't paid attention as a progressive movement. Our trade unions, our student organizations, our First Nation people, we haven't been discussing what's going on in the world and how it affects us, and we need to. So I'm not suggesting, you know, in every city in Canada, people are going to agree readily we have to go out and form a coalition to oppose Canadian intervention in Ukraine. I'd like to have that happen. We should be demanding that there be no Canadian troops in Ukraine, that Ukraine not become a member of NATO. And in fact, we should return to the historic demand of the left movement in Canada, which is Canada out of NATO. It used to be a plank in the platform of the New Democratic Party, and they tossed it aside 10 years ago. So, I mean, this could be the platform of the NDP, and we should be fighting for that. But from my standpoint, if the most successful fight that we can have to win progressive society in Canada, and I'm talking, you know, the members of the NDP, the members of the Green Party, the members of trade unions, the best thing I think we could be doing is forming a new party of the political left, a genuinely left and socialist party, which would have a very cooperative attitude and relationship towards the NDP and towards all of the other social and political organizations in the country. Because these are complicated issues, and they can't be solved by a group of us sitting around as a coalition. I mean, this requires political leadership and experience. We need to run in elections on a platform like this, or at least that's the anti-war plan. And then hear what Canadian people have to say, because we'll learn from them as they will learn from us. So, but I think that that's the course that we need to go on. We have a situation right now where there's only one thing that stands in the way of the Canadian government getting more deeply into NATO's war offensive, which is this legacy that we've established. We fought wars in the past. We fought for women's equality, and that's not something you can take easily away. First Nations people today are making gains in progress in achieving their sovereignty and their rights, against police violence, all of the social ills that we have quite a good track record of achieving this. But this has to cohere into politics, because we don't have a party in Parliament right now that speaks on these issues. So on this anti-war front, this narrow anti-war front, you know, these are the ideas that I think we need to be discussing, and I hope we could readily agree on these. I think they're pretty important, pretty basic and straightforward, but, you know, we need the discussion, because all of these things are complicated. But I hope that that's the path that we're embarked on increasingly. This conference today and tonight is an important part of that, and I'll continue to be part of that, and I look forward to all of your views on that as we go through the conference today and in the weeks and months and several years ahead. So thanks for your attention.
You've been listening to some of the audio from a conference on the dangers of NATO in a post-Cold War era. The speakers included moderator Radhika Desai of the University of Manitoba, Paul Kellogg of Athabasca University, Mahdi Darius Nazimroya, author of The Globalization of NATO, and Roger Annis, writer and founding editor of newcoldwar.org. Unabridged versions of all three talks, along with video, as well as a follow-up roundtable, can be found at the website geopoliticaleconomy.org. The events were recorded by Winnipeg-based videographer Paul Graham, and his YouTube channel is Paul S. Graham. Music this week was provided by Purple Planet Music. More of their music can be found at www.purple-planet.com. This has been the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our shows on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. Our programs are available for download at globalresearch.ca. To send your feedback on this or any of our other programs, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. The Global Research News Hour will return with new programs in September. Thank you for joining us. My name is Michael Welch. Please stay tuned for your next regularly scheduled program.